You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Morning, Bill.
Good morning, Matt. I still get to say good morning, Matt.
Likewise, I get to say good morning to you. It's good to see you.
So Matt Lewis is off this week, and special guest, a real treat, Matt Cooper, who now is my editor at the Washington Monthly, but you've had an illustrious career in journalism, which continues on at the Monthly. For folks, for some of the youngsters in the audience that might not know your resume, do you want to give folks a quick sum up of your work?
Sure. Well, I've worked for a lot of magazines over the years, including Time Magazine and The New Republic and Newsweek, mostly from here in Washington, covering politics, covering the White House on a few stints. And I started my career at the Washington Monthly, and now I'm back helping out on the digital side. So, I'm going to ride this print journalism thing all the way down, right till there's one last dead trees thing standing.
Your career sort of is, when you started, being at Time and Newsweek was, big. I mean, that was premier journalistic real estate.
Yeah. No. The slicks, or the weeklies, as they were called, really kind of set the agenda for the country, and they sold millions of copies, and they had lots of money, and they just were kind of, had a kind of influence that's hard to imagine now. Time is still around as a weekly news magazine, but it's not quite what it was. And, Newsweek and US News are greatly diminished, but it was fun while it lasted.
Maybe if we have some time, we can talk more about, state of media and your perspective on that.
Absolutely. I was at the New Republic, along with, Blogging Heads TV founder Robert Wright and Mickey Kaus, and so.
Are you hopeful for the next incarnation? Are you familiar with Mike Tomasky?
Yeah, I like Mike Tomasky. I think he'll do a good job.
We might circle back to media at the end, but let's get it to the latest news. Folks who've been following us know we've been pretty obsessed about the filibuster and Joe Manchin, and now Joe Manchin has his new op-ed, where it's not really anything new that he hasn't said before, but people got very overly excited when he talked about talking filibuster, thinking he was about to move. And now he's now leaning more heavily into, I don't like reconciliation, I don't think we should weaken the filibuster. Things he has said in the past, but people don't always believe it when he says it, and maybe they still don't believe it today. Right. But is your sense that Manchin is really trying to slow Biden's roll here and get him to do some serious bipartisan negotiation? Or is this more kabuki theater that is going to end up with Manchin falling in line behind some partisan infrastructure bill at the end of the day?
I feel like I've dated people like Joe Manchin. It's like, trying to figure out how into you they are is a constant struggle. And, it's hard to tell what he's doing. Is this all just kind of tactical to get more of what he wants? Is it to get the, veneer of bipartisanship, but he doesn't really think that's going to happen in the end? And does he even know his own mind in this? But, this is where you are with a 50-50 Senate. Everyone's a kingmaker. And it's kind of, to Schumer's credit, that 49 of them are pretty much in line. And he's the only one that isn't. I don't know. I think, if the first big bill is to be believed, he went along with this reconciliation procedure that, can smooth the passage with only 50 votes. After balking about that, he just kind of did it. Now this time he's being a little bulkier. But if you read the piece he did for the Post yesterday, that kind of was his latest pronunciation on this thing, it had wiggle room. It was not a declarative, I'm not going to vote for reconciliation.
Right.
So don't know. Your guess is as good as mine about where he ends up.
Yeah, I take it at face value that, as you said, he still could support reconciliation. But I think he means it when he says you got to go through the gauntlet of regular order before you're going to get me to that place. And that means actually giving Republicans the opportunity to offer amendments and see how they fly. What I don't see Manchin doing, which I find strange, he could force bipartisan talks more if he want to. He could say, I am now going to meet with Mitt Romney. He has this loose group of 20. They're having these chit chats, but they don't seem to really involve real back and forth, at least not yet. He could say, this is the game in town. We are going to write this bill, and we're going to show you our work, you know, in a month or two. And he hasn't escalated to that degree, at least not yet.
Right. I think that's right. He needs to bring the poker game to his house.
Now, when I was writing my last piece, you flagged for me because I've fallen out of the habit of watching all the Sunday shows because I find them not as nutritious as they used to be.
No.
But you flagged for me that Senator Roy Blunt was on Fox News Sunday and said, hey, if we're doing a roads and bridges bill, or even specified water, maybe utilities.
I think he threw in some broadband too.
Yeah. And we were around $618 billion, like he would be good with that. Now, that's very parallel to how the relief plan talk started and quickly ended when Susan Collins' group said, hey, we can do $600 billion. And the Biden people said, that's nowhere near what we want. This is not worth our time. We're going to move without you. But in this case, it's not as clear that Biden can move without them. Joe Manchin could say this Roy Blunt offer is worth teasing out more, but he hasn't done that yet. But I feel like that's something in the mix here that's not getting a lot of attention, where there is a little bit of an offer on the table. It would require Biden stripping out. I mean, if I was to take Blunt's offer as is, it would require stripping out long-term care, housing, school construction, a lot of things that Democrats want. But as an opening bid, to take it at face value, so people think you shouldn't, it is something. It's more than zero.
Right. No, I think that's right. I mean, if the Republicans were still in the position that they were under Paul Ryan at the beginning of Trump's term, where the only infrastructure they were putting on the table was these sort of privatization leverage schemes to, you know, have privatized toll booths and stuff. That's not 100% crazy, but it's not really going to get the job done. If that's where they were, I think Manchin would just go to reconciliation. But they're going to have to go through this exercise. I think the question is, at the end of the day, when there aren't 10 senators for, a deal, is he just going to say, well, we tried, and, you know, vote for a big bill or not? And I don't know.
I mean, it's hard to know where, if there is 10. I mean could you get 10 for Blunt's bill right now, in theory? Would there be 10 Republicans for just straight up roads, bridges, water, broadband, you know, a quarter of the size of what Biden asked for, where they'd say, hey, we knocked them back and we got some money for our own districts and we can call it a day?
Yeah, you could probably get 10. I mean, Blunt's kind of in the center of the Republican conference, so that's probably doable. But then you do get big Democratic pushback on that. You know, there's just a lot who won't go along with the smaller bill, even if it might make sense to. So I think we have to go on this little journey with Joe to see where he ends up. And he has voted for a lot of, you know, liberal bills where you think he would have maybe balked. And I don't know. I tend to think Biden's going to get a lot of what he wants, but I don't know.
I mean, there's also this question of what can you get into reconciliation? You can do a fair amount of infrastructure.
Yeah. Right. You can't put everything in there. So, we still have more parliamentarian games to play out here.
I mean, the one thing I feel like I've learned in the past 2 months is that nobody really knows what can get in and what can't get in.
Right. I think it's like, yeah, it's like, you know, the old thing about Supreme Court and pornography. Right. You know it when you see it, and it's, you know, the parliamentarian's kind of winging it too. I mean, it's pretty funny, the fate of all this stuff is dependent on like a career civil servant who makes pronunciations. You know, we'll see. I don't know, but I think it's going to keep whipsawing. You know, when the parliamentarian ruled, I think it felt like, oh my God, Biden's going to get this. And then Manchin really pushed back. So I think we'll go through a lot of incarnations of that in the next few months.
From your past journalism, are there any parallel examples of bills like this that proved complicated for Democrats to get their own ducks in line? Because infrastructure, you know, on the top line is, yes, let's spend government money on public works projects. Democrats like that. Then you get down to the weeds of it and the specific projects, the specific pay-fors, and you start to see more it seems like we're seeing some fissures materialize right now. Are there examples from the past that make one think, you know, this is good, this is not going to be the relief bill. This is going to be a much more complicated negotiation than what we just saw.
Yeah, I have seen some. I mean, I think there's a general rule of sort of entropy that if these things don't keep moving, the longer they kind of sit and get debated, the less likely they pass. I mean, you know, support doesn't build over a really long time. It tends to dissipate. I mean, you saw it's not exactly parallel. You saw that with the Clinton healthcare, you know, proposals in 93, 94. Where it came out of the gate strongly with Democrats. Democrats had a huge majority. They could have passed it. But, they, you know, support waned terribly. I covered this tobacco settlement in the 90s that kind of splintered. You know, so it's tough to build. It's tougher to build support over time than to lose it.
Now, I was always befuddled during the Obama years why the infrastructure bank never got done. It seemed like something that had bipartisan appeal. It wasn't a lot of, you know, direct government money. It was drawing on private money. And then I was flipping back through the Michael Grunwald book, The New New Deal, where he mentioned that, you know, that was talked about early in the Recovery Act process. And a lot of Congress people didn't like it because it was taking the power. It was ending the earmark era and putting the power into the executive branch where the money's going to go. And they didn't want to codify that. Now we've had earmark bans. You know, the Obama people never liked the earmarks. They thought it was bad politics. And, you know, Trump didn't do earmarks either. Now Democrats, they want to bring back earmarks. But from what I've read and what we saw in the relief plan process, you can't do earmarks in reconciliation. At least they tried to a few in the relief plan that the parliamentarians struck out. So does that complicate the game to 50? Or is there such an appetite for earmarks now that they say, well, we really want them. We got to work with Republicans to get them, and we want to give their earmarks too. Or are they going to say earmarks aren't that important? We've lived without them for a decade. We'll move on a different track.
Well, I think earmarks are good, and they sort of grease the wheels of legislation. And, you know, while there's some ridiculous projects, most of them are fine. And in an age where you want stimulus, even a ridiculous project, you know, puts money in pockets and, you know, does good things. But I don't know if it's such a huge bill. I don't know if like money for the, you know, for some interchange or a, you know, museum of corn or whatever is going to be enough to really move a lot of votes. But it would be better to have them in than not, for sure.
I've been to the Corn Palace in South Dakota. I'm not sure if it's gotten federal money before. I bet it has. I bet it got some at some point.
Right. I've been to this transportation museum in Pennsylvania that the Republican Bill Schuster, who was a big pork appropriations guy, you know, made sure was funded. So
was that Steamtown?
Yeah. I think so. It's been a while. Of course, there was that famous Bridge to Nowhere.
Right. Which was probably, I'm sure I wrote meanings of the Bridge to Nowhere back in those days, but from what I understand, you know, a bridge in rural Alaska is kind of important for people to actually be able to go anywhere because there's so many isolated communities.
Right, exactly. Exactly. No, I think they're basically good. And, you know, it also gives Congress more power than the executive on some things, and I think that's generally a good thing, too. I don't know. It's a lot to play out. I mean, but if he gets it, if Biden gets a huge second bill here, I mean, it's pretty amazing. He's sort of like LBJ without Vietnam, you know?
Well, sir, I mean, infrastructure potentially, a lot of the relief bill is not legacy stuff. If they can get the child tax credit expansion to be permanent, or a long-term extension, right. that's a legacy item. But the rest of it is more temporary. Let's get out of this current mess. A big infrastructure bill, $1 trillion, $2 trillion infrastructure bill is going to have a lot of projects that you can slap Biden's name on in perpetuity.
Yeah, totally. And I it's always hard to kill government programs. You know, mm-hmm. I think it took 70 years to kill rural electrification.
Yeah,
you know, long after people had plugs in their homes.
Although I'm also interested, you know, I wrote a piece, you know, a few weeks ago about Biden. Biden still hasn't scheduled the first congressional address, the first joint session of Congress address, which is technically not State of the Union when it's your first year, but it's like a State of the Union.
Right.
Still not scheduled yet. They're claiming COVID protocol hangups. But I think part of it is I'm not sure they know what to say in it just yet. They still want to decide on their priorities, but we seem to have a de facto prioritization happening. My concern was that he wasn't setting the priorities and expectations were going to go off the rails. But infrastructure has started to crowd out voting reform, immigration, minimum wage. You know, this is the big right. ball game right now, and everybody knows it's going to take several months. So on the best case scenario, they get it. They get it by the fall. And I agree with you. I mean, you could argue that relief plan plus infrastructure bill, that's pretty darn good for a first term. You can kind of, you know, hum along after that.
Yeah.
But I think there's this question, like, what could you do next? Because you're running out of things you can do through reconciliation.
Right. Well, clearly they've put the other stuff off to the side. I think there's something maybe to be said about putting off the speech too. You know, normally the State of the Union or its equivalent is a great chance, unparalleled chance for a president to, you know, have a huge audience, most all the TV networks. You know, it's a lot of attention on you in one shot where you get to make your case, and it tends to play well for any president. In this case, you know, he's doing pretty well anyway. Just going into the chamber kind of galvanizes the two teams on their sides. It would probably give him a lift, but you can make a case that there's a good reason he's in no rush to do it.
Well, to your point about galvanization, drawing from, you know, your career, Republicans seem to be more, in a sense, more in disarray than we're used to seeing. You know, they didn't splinter on the relief bill, but their messaging doesn't seem very tight. They don't seem to have they have had a very organized pushback to the Biden presidency. Is that starting to change? Are we starting to see a Republican Party more like the Republican Party we're used to? Big fat target of excessive, you know, tax and spend bill.
Yeah.
They're in their groove. They're in their wheelhouse. They can stay united to fight that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I think they are not there yet. I think they have things to work with from Biden. As you said, they could just go back to the old hits, you know, tax and spend, a lot of government, And that doesn't have to just be empty rhetoric. They can make a legitimate case of like, look, the economy is turning around. We've already done trillions in stimulus. You know, there's no reason to rush and do this. They could make that case, but that's kind of not what they're doing. They're doing, you know, one of the raps on Republicans in the first half of the 20th century was that they were dime store New Deal, that they were kind of for the New Deal, just a lot less money for it. You know, and they are for these big, you know, stimulus payments. They are for a pretty big infrastructure deal. They're just for a lot less of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to the degree they focused on Dr. Seuss and, transitional hormones in state contests, you know, for trans people, it's, you know, they're not really, yeah, they're definitely not really on their game. I'm kind of surprised by how off they are.
Well, they also seem sort of betwixt and between when it comes to corporations.
Yes.
I mean, you would think they would be poised to hammer Biden for a giant tax increase on corporations, job-killing tax increases. These are the engines of recovery, and Biden right. wants to put them, you know, in a hammer lock, and instead they're mad that they're siding with the Democrats on Georgia's voting reform law, which you know I'm an annoyingly, you know, maybe less of a lone voice than in the past, but I keep saying that these bills aren't as impactful as people are making them out to be, or at least potentially not as impactful.
Yes, you've been joined by Nate Cohen.
Man. Yeah, I mean, although I was mad that Nate was getting all the attention for making the argument I was making 2 weeks ago, but now he's getting dragged so much on social media, perhaps it's better he's getting the heat than I am.
Right. No, that was a very smart piece in the Washington Monthly you did. I agree. They've got one foot in the like corporate America is killing you and it's all Mark Zuckerberg's fault and woke Coca-Cola. And then they got one foot in just kind of old style Chamber of Commerce politics. And they can't quite decide which way to go.
Now, would it behoove Democrats? You know, Democrats are definitely, I think, in more of an antitrust mood.
Right.
But is there an opening for Democrats to say, hey, Coca-Cola, hey, Amazon, why don't you come on our team for a little bit? I'll go easy on you with your loopholes, but you lean your shoulder and help us get infrastructure passed and a carbon tax passed and minimum wage passed and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think on the legislative side, you know, a lot is still depending on what Merrick Garland and the antitrust division of the Justice Department and the FTC does. I mean, are they going to really start to go after, you know, try to break up big companies? Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know the answer yet. Mm-hmm. But they seem definitely more inclined to than Obama.
Although if they went, you know, hard on antitrust, I mean, you can divide and conquer the corporate world. You know, not every corporation is going to get broken up, just some of the real big dogs. So
right.
Maybe there's mid-sized corporations that don't care and feel like, hey, I can still get my piece of what I want in these big bills, and I don't need fealty to the Republicans here. They've gone off the deep end. They're more interested in playing culture war games. I don't need to swim in that pool. I can do some transactional politics with the Democrats, and that'll be better for me.
Yeah, I think they could definitely do that. You know, they got a lot of these corporations on their side anyway. Certainly on these social issues, they don't have to push them on that. Mm-hmm. And even things like minimum wage, you know, for the big, that's more a thing for the, you know, NFIB, which yeah. represents smaller businesses. Mm-hmm. For the, you know, for the big Fortune 500, they're paying, you know, $15 for most everything anyway.
But Amazon's been sort of complaining. We're already doing 15. Why don't you get everybody else to right. come
we're
up so we're
great.
Not?
Yeah. I'm a little surprised Biden did as big a tax increase because, you know, once you're borrowing trillions anyway, I mean, you know, why go through the whole raise taxes thing?
Well, I'm curious. To what extent?
Spending is increasingly divorced from revenue. So, you know, put it on the tab, right?
Well, I don't know if it is.
Get the bottle service.
Is it Biden trying to, you know, go big so we can easily give away concessions and say he compromised? And or is it people at his own party, the Joe Manchin, Angus King, Mark Warner? So those folks were saying, look, we can't spend into oblivion. The rules of macroeconomics and deficit politics have not, you know, been evaporated. We guys are paying for something here. And if you don't start doing some of that, we're gonna walk. And so Biden's gotta give a nod in that direction.
Yeah, I imagine you know, Yellen had thoughts on this and they were not gonna, and Biden's instincts would be to pay for stuff. You know. But it says something about our time that it's even plausible you could just put another few trillion on the tab. I mean, we didn't pay for the last trillion,
right,
so,
right.
You know, why start getting a conscience?
I mean, it's going to be true until you get to that point where you have inflation. I mean, you know, everyone thinks that Larry Summers is being too much of a worry word, and again, I'm not a macroeconomist, and plenty of people like the Fed chair and Goldman Sachs and others said that Summers was being too skittish, but you got to assume at some point over the course of history, we'll have inflation again for whatever reason. We've been this very long stretch of very modest inflation, which is unusual. The moment where that is no longer the case, all the spending, all the fiscal scolds will pour out. And so you got to start clamping down.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't want to be president when that happens.
Right.
I mean, inflation screws everybody, whereas unemployment doesn't screw everybody.
We were talking a little bit about this before we started recording. You were saying to me that you are, maybe you should talk about this a little bit in more detail, that there's an uptick in crime that hasn't yet changed or influenced Biden's agenda. And the reason why I bring it up as we talk about, you know, spending is, you know, Biden seems to be very inclined to not get crosswired with the base as of yet. You know, there's certain things that he's drawing lines on. He's not going to cancel student debt unilaterally. He's not saying, hey, every migrant, come on in, the water's warm. You know, there are a few things like that where he's not doing exactly what the base wants, but a lot of it, he's not proposing things that are really going against the grain. He's going generally big. Is there a point where he has to make that triangulation pivot? Or is that just not good politics right now? Is it better just to keep your base tight with you for as long as humanly possible? And that means even if there is an uptick in crime, if that's going to upset your base, to move away from more progressive criminal justice reform, it's not worth appealing to, you know, that working class white voter that gets all bent out of shape when crime spikes.
Well, I think it's doable. I mean, first, the problem is you do have this crime spike. It's gone on for a while now. And, you know, I think there's some debate about the causation. Is it because, you know, mayors like de Blasio got soft on crime? Is it something to do with the economy and the pandemic? Is it, you know, still something else that we don't quite get? For whatever reason, you know, I live in Washington, D.C. The murder rate's way up. There would have an incredible spate of carjackings going on. And it's, you know, it's disturbing here. It's disturbing a lot of American cities. And I think, you know, just to be responsible, I think you want to address it. And then politically, it seems to me doable to do it in a way like, look, we want to address this problem, but we're not going back to, you know, rogue cops and mass incarceration. And, you know, we're going to be smart about this. You know, we're going to put more community police or patrol on the streets or something. I mean, I think there's a way to do it that Democrats can get behind. That doesn't seem like a return to the, you know, the bad old days. And I'm a little surprised Biden, who's, you know, was the author of the crime bill. You know, Bruce Reed, Deputy White House Chief of Staff, who was big in all these things. Merrick Garland. I'm a little surprised that they have not been more out front on this.
We don't even buy it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I mean, the 94 crime bill wasn't just like the one time Biden was involved in crime. I mean, he was doing criminal justice, crime reform stuff, you know, all through the 80s. I mean, it's almost like one of his main purposes as a Democrat was, I'm gonna yank the Democrats from the left edge and rebrand them as law and order so we can be more politically viable with the center of the country. And Bill Clinton, you know, went along for that ride. And Biden's always had that antenna for trying to find the middle. And it just seems like right now that antenna is being used to where are the places that will make the middle happy without upsetting my base. Infrastructure makes both left and middle happy. Checks for everybody makes both left and middle happy. Expand the definition of infrastructure to include long-term care. Plenty of average Americans would like to have help with long-term care costs because they're stressed on a whole swath of people.
Yeah.
So he's finding those spots, but he's not going for the spots where it's going to start causing rifts between left and center, at least not yet.
No, I think that's right. And also, it's not a thing that, you know, where success is likely or guaranteed. I mean, he can start to address it, but he won't necessarily solve it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've seen the power of the crime issue to do so much damage to Democrats and to progressive goals that you really can't let it sit. And, you know, I think there are sensible ways to approach it. So, you know, maybe he'll get to it. He does have bigger things going on. I mean, these bills are, you know, just enormous, but at some point he's got to get to it. Well, Harris would be good to, you know, we were starting to talk about Harris before the show, but, you know, as a prosecutor, you know, knows this terrain, you know, she could be out front on this.
So you were saying to me, you know, beforehand, that you think it's interesting how Harris's most prominent task that she's been given in the first few months has been to run point on the border issue. Which is hardly, you know, a fun job.
Thanks, Joe. Right. Thanks, so, boss.
What do you think is behind that?
I can't quite figure it out. I mean, it's a shitty job just because it's, you know, it seems very intractable. It's not as fun as like what Obama gave Biden to run the stimulus program. I mean, Biden was supposed to police it to make sure there was no corruption, but a lot of it was just like handing out checks. You know, going to, you know, bridge openings and things. I don't know. She hasn't really dived in. She was getting some grief in the White House press briefing yesterday about like going to Chicago instead of the Texas border. And, you know, why isn't she down at the border? And what's she doing on this? And she's only talked to the Guatemalan president. And, you know, there's a little something to that. I mean, at some point she's going to have to really, you know, kind of publicly embrace it and do at least show a sense of action more than, you know, than we've seen so far. I mean, she's smart enough and it's important enough to the president. I can't believe she won't, but we're not quite there yet.
I mean, if it is something that at the end of it all, she is seen as helping to solve, that would be a positive for her.
That's true. And this surge may abate on its own.
Right.
And, you know, they can kind of get credit for it.
But I would have thought that, I mean, I think the Biden people have an interest in propping her up, an interest in having her seen as the successor. I mean, I don't feel like they're trying to keep her down.
No.
And I think she would, I mean, if I was in her inner circle, I would be saying, look, Biden beat Trump because he did well with in the suburbs, and he wasn't too he didn't fall through the floor, you know, in amongst what working class whites. You know, obviously we're still weak there, but it didn't get, you know, demonstrably worse. You're still seen as a very coastal person, blue state, blue city person. You need to build some relationships and have some familiarity with the swing state areas and the districts. Let's get you out into the middle of the country. Let's get you onto factory floors, talking to lunch pail workers, be there for business reopenings, things of that nature. I don't feel like they're deploying her in that way, which I feel like, I mean, we don't know if Biden's going to run again or not in 4 years' time. He indicated that he wasn't trying to be seen as a lame duck, but the possibility exists that he won't run in 2024 for health reasons or whatever. So I would feel like there's no time to lose here. And I just don't think that project is underway. I don't feel like that expansion of her brand in less, you know, deep blue areas has been embarked upon yet.
Yeah, I think that's right. She's kind of been an echo of him, like doing immunization events, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, messaging the stuff that they do already, but it's not really kicked up her profile enough. Well, I think you saw a little bit of this after the convention till the fall. You know, I don't think she was. It seemed to me, I may be wrong about it, but she was deployed in sort of, you know, minority areas more to kind of get the vote out. And, you know, I thought she had greater appeal and greater talents than they kind of had her doing.
I mean, that made some sense for 2020, you know, send Biden to the Rust Belt and send Harris to the Sun Belt. I wonder, you know, to what extent do most Democrats think that polarization is here to stay? It's never going to get any better. We're never going to win back white working class. You know, Biden did, you know, again, he didn't go through the floor, but it still wasn't good. We won. Yeah. Because we did better in suburban areas with white college educated voters, and we married that with our natural base of people of color. And that trend's going to continue. And so Harris doesn't need to bend over backwards. You know, we're going to get by with that kind of coalition, and that doesn't require serious brand retooling.
Yeah. Well, there's some truth to that, but, you know, obviously there's fluidity in all segments of the electorate. You know, we see that in the Hispanic drop-off for Democrats. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't count on the world staying as it is. And, you know, you got to always – and also you can't let, you know, Republicans run up the rural and white blue-collar margins to such a degree in so many places. I mean, you may not win them, but you can't let them, you know, go 80-20.
Right. I mean, that's sort of where my head is at. That you, if you're going to, if races are going to continue to be close, you got to watch those margins and not have an overly simplistic demographic view of your base, even though it might be generally true. But if you follow that logic, you know, too narrowly, you're going to find you're more vulnerable than you thought.
Yeah, I think that's right. Anyway, it's I think she's got considerable. I mean, she's talented, and I you know, the right hates her, but I think she's got a lot of skill, and they're crazy. I think she could be used in more creative ways.
I agree with that too, and I was very bullish on her, you know, being VP, and I think she has a pragmatic bent, which I think is going to come in handy as she tries to navigate these sorts of politics. I'm just not seeing it as much. It's not being that pragmatic side of her is not being put on tour.
Yeah, put her on the crime stuff, among other things.
Now, there's a piece I'm working on. So you haven't seen my piece yet. This is like me going for extra help and getting some guidance, right, before I finish my assignment. But I'm working on a piece about the New York City mayoral race, Andrew Yang, and ranked choice voting. And I've never been a big Yang fan. I wrote a Yang piece for Politico during the campaign where I was very skeptical about how he was handling UBI. And now he's running for one of the most difficult jobs in government, period. Right. Mayor of New York City is not, you know, an entry-level job, in my opinion. And it's not, I mean, I didn't vote for Michael Bloomberg in 2001. I was very, I lived in New York City in 2001. And I remember hearing after 9/11, we're in this massive crisis. We need a businessman. I'm like, those data points don't make any sense at all. There's no connection between being hit by terrorists and being someone with no government experience to be mayor. But of course, the propaganda, the Giuliani afterglow was just too much, and they did a number on Mark Green that was really just brutal.
Yes,
but that aside, the notion that Yang is really positioned to have this job, I find kind of ludicrous. Now, granted, you know, there are people in history who surprise you, who you don't think make any sense, sure, and they end up meeting the moment. So I don't want to say it's impossible Yang can't do a good job. But if you are an advocate for ranked choice voting, if you want to see ranked choice voting really take off, this is the biggest test for ranked choice voting. This is the biggest jurisdiction that has had ranked choice voting yet. And if, I mean, it's not just Yang that's a potential tripwire here. There's the question of how well voters are going to understand it. And there's some question whether the education campaign is going well right now. There's the question of the tabulation, how well the Board of Elections is going to handle the vote count. So you know, they could all screw things up that are irrespective of Yang and irrespective of what the average voter can do about it. But let's say, you know, the vote goes fine. Yang wins because either he had, you know, he had a plurality of first choice votes, but it wasn't a strong plurality, but he had a good chunk of second place votes. Or maybe he doesn't even have the most first place votes, but he has a lot of second place votes because he's got the highest name ID. He has the highest name ID by more than 20 points of the next person in the race.
Right.
Which is crazy because he's not even from New York City. but he's got his TV time, and you have a field of like 40 candidates, most of whom are not well known. And they're all having a hard time breaking out of the pack. So in theory, you can see Yang sneaking through the primary in a low turnout race because he's got the highest name ID, even though people don't really know what he's going to do as mayor or if he has the skills to do what he wants to do. And then if you don't have a good Republican nominee, I don't think there's not a Bloomberg type running right now. So chances are Democratic nominee is the winner in November. He gets there. He has a terrible job. And everyone says, how the hell did we get this guy? Screw this ranked choice voting business. That really messed us up here. That's the worst case scenario for ranked choice voting advocates. So if I'm a ranked choice voting guy, if I want this to be a model for other cities and states to follow, I don't want the New York City voters to screw this up. I might want to say, hey, let's get the word out that Yang should not be the face of ranked choice voting. Don't give him a lazy second place vote because he's the guy you've heard of before. Band together and prevent that. Right. One of the things with the ranked choice voting is that I think it really expects a lot of strategic voting on the part of voters. You got to think a lot harder about your vote than with a regular vote. And I'm not sure everyone's prepared to do that yet because they don't really understand. And it's hard to even know like what is the strategic play in various cases because you don't have good poll data, you don't know who the candidates are. It's hard to know what exactly is the right thing to do. But I think that's where this could really go off the rails for New York City and for ranked choice voting.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, like runoffs were originally intended in most places. Mm-hmm. You know, they were meant to sort of weed out, you know, losing candidates or oddball candidates, you know, by making them get a full majority and not just a plurality. And this was supposed to, you know, create a best choice for a particular party. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's any guarantee in either place that's what happens. But, you know, Yang is reflective of the moment, right? I mean, his one issue in the campaign was universal basic income. You know, now we're all on the dole. You know, everyone's on welfare now. We've sort of busted our mental blocks about getting a government check. Now it's just like a thing. It's a thing. You know, he has a little bit of, you know, I mean, he does have a little sparkle that got him this attention.
Oh, yeah.
And he sort of talks like, I mean, he talks like a human being, and he was, you know, he was kind of forgiving on the racial stuff, you know, the comedian who made the anti-Asian slur, and, you know, instead of, you know, calling for, you know, boycotts or other things, he was sort of generous in his dealings with the guy. And so, you know, he's got some charisma, but I've got a friend who got a little investment money from Yang a few years ago for a thing he was doing. And
the Venture for America thing?
Different thing. And he got some money, but, you know, Yang said he had some, you know, plans and wasn't going to be doing this for a while. My friend said, "What are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm running for president." You know? It was like, if your neighbor said it.
Right.
It was like, oh, okay. So, I there's some interesting candidates in the race. Ray McGuire, who's a big, big executive at Citicorp, and African-American Harvard grad, I think kind of a sleeper in all this. You know, we'll see how it plays out. But Yang kind of, it's also, there's an interesting piece, I think, Politico, about how he's kind of had to embrace his Asian-ness more than he has, you know, and that's kind of his strength is, you know, there hasn't been a really serious Asian candidate for mayor in New York ever, you know, kind of that community is, you know, feeling, both because of these, you know, awful crimes against Asian Americans, but also a kind of sense of, you know, emerging power and claims on these offices. You know, it makes sense for him to be, going out to Korean restaurants and, you know, Queens and stuff. And so that's kind of an interesting part of it too.
I think your point about his general geniality and charisma, I think, is very relevant here, because it's not just name ID. It's how he got his name ID by being that guy. And right now he's in the lead, but with a thin plurality. You can stop that with an organized, you know, stop Yang movement. But if you're going at Yang hard, it's that attacking Bambi problem. You sound like such a jackass throwing a round ass at Andrew Yang because he seems like such a nice guy. But that's why, right. I feel like,
and
go on.
Yeah. With crime back in New York, I just wonder if people think he's like tough enough to deal with it. You know, so many elections since World War II have been driven by crime in New York. You know, who could handle it, who could deal with it, whether it was, you know, Lindsay through gentle appeals to, you know, the community, or Giuliani by being, you know, Mussolini. It's always been about, the big issue has always been about crime, and until de Blasio, when the rates got so low that, like, you know, he didn't have to run on crime control. You know, we'll see where Yang is in 2 months.
But I think the person who's been running second has generally been Eric Adams, although, I mean, this is a very crowded field, so right. It's not like it's like a clear second. But Adams, I believe, is ex-police.
He's good, damn it. Yeah, he's ex-police. He's got good, you know, he lost like 100 pounds and some diet, and so he's, he's got like a cookbook or something. You know, I lost weight book, which, you know, is very relatable for people, and he's a good candidate.
I mean, I just think you got to get to a place. I mean, to some extent, the experience gap wasn't as wide in the Democratic primary, but Biden was able to play his experience card pretty well. And often experience cards aren't great cards. You know, most of the time I feel people vote values, not resume. But in this case, you know, you're in a serious time. I mean, the average New Yorker knows, you know, this is a job that manages, you know, over 300,000 workers, you know, $90 million budget, control of the of 1,800 schools, a million kids, and control of the police force. You know, this is not a weak mayor position. This is a pretty big position.
No.
And I think you got to find a way to get it. If you are going to stop in, you got to say, look, you know, the fun and games is over. This is a real job, and someone who knows how this all works needs to be in this position. I mean, maybe there's a way to do that without seeming like a total jerk and being mean to Yang. But you got to get that message out there, or else he's going to run away with it on name ID.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the opposition has a lot to work with. The question is whether they're, you know, too divided to make this work, but you know, it's definitely easy to see Yang putting together a coalition of like Upper West Side liberals who find him sort of, you know, charming, and you know, Asian Americans, and peeling off enough other places that you know he gets there.
But the coordination is the tricky part. I think you would need. I mean, maybe not in ads, but maybe it's more under the radar where all the candidates say, "Look, just tell your people." Don't vote Yang number two. Just do that much. If everyone can agree not to vote Yang number two, right. If you want Yang, you want Yang. I can't tell you who you don't want first. But for God's sake, don't make him number two.
Right. It is hard to see him in like the LaGuardia, Lindsay, Koch, you know, tradition of. I mean, New York's had colorful mayors, but they haven't really had lightweight mayors. Right. And.
You can see Yang going around town saying, how am I doing? That's the thing Yang would do.
Yeah, it's hard to see him with the sanitation strike. Yeah. You know?
I mean, he's never been tested. I mean, people can surprise, you know? But it just, you have no idea what you're getting there as far as that nuts and bolts mayor stuff.
I mean, the problem is you do have a lot of dull apparatchiks run for these offices in New York. You know, who have like been running for them forever and, you know, work their way through comptroller and, you know, all these other kind of miserable jobs. And, you know, there is some relief to somebody who's not gone through all that.
Yeah, it hasn't been, no one has climbed the ranks in New York that way. You know, you have city comptroller is elected, public advocate is elected, but. Right. They haven't been good stepping stones. You had Giuliani was attorney. Dinkins was borough president, right?
Dinkins was borough. Beam was comptroller.
Okay, so maybe Beam was the last comptroller guy.
Koch and Lindsay were congressmen. No, it would be very tough for, just total outsider to pull this off.
I mean, de Blasio was a city councilor. I mean, that's sort of the last person to kind of make that jump. But he leapfrogged over the council president. And
he understood the anti-Bloomberg moment much more than, you know, Quinn did, who was the front runner and was not tough enough on the mayor. And, you know, he caught that moment.
And he navigated the racial politics very ably.
Totally. And another another case of like Anthony Weiner changing American history, because, you know, Weiner. Excellent chance Weiner could have won that primary. He was back.
Yeah.
And, of course, he also elected Trump. Damn laptop. So he gave us de Blasio and Trump. It's hard to imagine greater crimes against humanity.
Are you deeply anti de Blasio?
No, I think the rap on him was a little too much, but, you know, it takes a lot to alienate as many people as he has. I mean, that really, he's really gone out of his way to do that.
I just find him so fascinating because there is this deep reservoir of de Blasio hate, yet he won two races in a cakewalk. he did something right.
Yeah, and his polls aren't that bad. But, you know, and I think his progressive goals were pretty good. But, you know, between the schools and everything else, he's also screwed up a lot. I don't know. That's been such a weird experience because, you know, he was staff to Andrew Cuomo at HUD in the 90s. So, you know, I don't think we've ever had a mayor who worked for a governor previously. I mean, it's bizarre.
Was there anything else we want to talk about before we wrapped up?
I think we hit the big stuff.
Well, if there's this thought you have on our declining state of media that you wanted to get into.
Oh, God. Well, I don't know if I have a lot to contribute to that. You know, someone will find a easier way for, you know, these things to make money. Here's my private beef is, how come there's no, like, easy pass for Substack? I'm not going to, you know, subscribe to, like, all my friends' Substacks for, you know, more than $1,000. But if you give me a easy pass where I can give them some money for an occasional piece, I mean, I always thought they should have that for, you know, other outlets anyway. I'm not going to, you know, we all have subscription fatigue. I'm not going to subscribe to the Miami Herald, but, you know, if I see a good story, I'll pay them a buck.
Now, Timothy Noah, who writes for the Monthly sometimes, you know, he had a big essay where I think he had a Substack, I don't know if he still has a Substack, but he was criticizing Substack for these payments that had been given to a select group of writers, and right. weren't totally Substack transparent about it.
Right, Substack seeded the thing by like paying some big writers up front to sort of get the brand up. Substack, I guess, can handle it how they want. I mean, I'm kind of amazed how many other companies could have been Substack, you know, Medium or, you know, one of the big, you know, Facebook or whatever. This idea was kind of sitting there. So it's, you know, kudos to them for thinking of it. I just think as a reader, like, I'm not going to subscribe to all these.
I'm flummoxed. I mean, I'm an old time blogger. I was blogging since, you know, 2002.
I wasn't alive then.
I know. This is Matt. It's another Matt.
Oh, I thought you blogged
with
another Matt.
Hi.
this is Laz.
Hi, it's my Laz.
Hi, Laz.
Okay, well, I can help you in a little bit, but I need to finish this up. Okay.
My lunch isn't that long.
I got one kid back in full person school, but one kid still in hybrid. But in a few weeks, she'll be full time in person again. So I mean, I feel like, you know, from regular blogging to Medium to Substack, I mean, it's all blogging. It's all versions of blogging.
Right.
And I like blogs. I mean, I don't have a problem with the basic concept of people getting to, you know, share their thoughts unedited. What I find weird with the Substack phenomenon, seeing people, if I may name names, you know, Greenwald, Iglesias, and such, I don't understand. This is just, I guess, my lack of entrepreneurial spirit. If I had a steady gig where I was making a lot of money where I was, I wouldn't jump ship to an independent blog where my revenue is contingent upon maintaining a fan base, which could be very fickle, and I don't have the benefit of an editor refining my thoughts. So when I've looked at a Greenwald piece or an Iglesias piece, I always feel like you've got way too much room to run here, guy. You really could have used an editor to really distill this down.
Right.
Why am I paying you money so you could write worse copy? Like that model's add up to me. Now, of course, they may have fan bases that love them enough that they're not thinking along, you know, my lines. But if I had a salary, I wouldn't give that up for this model.
Right. But they're making at least those top of the charts guys are making so much more money.
Yeah, yeah.
Than even their already healthy salaries, you know.
It only helps to get a 6-figure payout up front, but.
Yeah, why not go for it in any publication that's vulnerable to, you know, sinking? these days. So there's nothing steady about being in Rolling Stone if you're Matt Taibbi. I mean, you know, God knows what could happen to that at some point.
Right. That jump, so, I understand more.
Yeah, I think if you're up at that level of sort of, you know, I can see the logic of it. But it's, I agree about the editing. I mean, there is a lot of just, you know, oh my God, you keep it to 1500. You're still going on.
And I can write long, so I'm not in a position to judge.
Yeah, no. But you know, a lot of people don't need you.
Usually if I'm writing long, I feel like there's a reason for it. I'm not throwing in superfluous stuff. I try to keep my sentence structure tight.
Right. No, and you do. You're it's always good. It's always good. Well, we'll see what the new thing is that unseats Substack.
But certainly this the notion that Substack's a great way to make money, you know, I did it, you can too, obviously doesn't work if I got a six-figure payout and you're not going to get that payout.
No, totally. I mean, it's like a weight, you know, it's like a weight loss ad, you know, where they show someone who's like super buff. I guess you can, it could happen to you. It's probably not going to happen to you.
I guess that's why I haven't, you know, I mean, I blogged for so long and never made any money doing it that I have not been very inclined to go back into that pool and try to make things work that way.
Yes, is this professional jealousy or just...
Oh, I have consumer professional jealousy. Everyone should understand right. That I have nothing but bitter envy to all of these people.
No, me too.
Especially people like you, like Iglesias, who we were blogging at the same time. So that, of course, always like super sticks in your craw.
No, totally. Well, it's also, if you've been pushed out like Andrew Sullivan or Barry Weiss, it's got a particular sort of... You know, frisson of revenge too. It's not like you just took a job at Time or something,
right?
Hi,
Laz is back.
Laz is back.
Hi, Laz. I'll hand him over.
Can I get a cat?
What? If you can find a cat.
Okay. Oh, I'm definitely not the one to ask.
What is he saying?
He said he's not the one to ask about finding a cat. Are there things at the monthly or things of your own work that you want to plug?
No, I mean, I think the Washington Monthly has been really smart about all this antitrust stuff, about education reform. And of course, it's got a lot of Bill Scheer in print. So, you know, that's a reason to go there. And it's not behind the paywall. No paywall.
You don't sweet.
Have to, we're not going to, I mean, subscribe because that's good for America.
I mean, there still is a Washington Monthly print copy.
Absolutely, and if you want that, you're gonna have to pay for it. But if you want a little share, you know, it's where you go.
You know, I got someone in the operation sent me the last issue. I haven't gotten a magazine in so long. It was a special treat. Wow, a magazine!
I know. You're like, what is this?
This I want to go on an airplane now and read this magazine.
Yeah, totally.
What? I'm fine. So yes, check out the monthly. Hopefully I can get this Yang piece done soon and reap the wrath of the Yang gang any minute.
I think you'll be okay.
and hope we can get you back on next time you know, Matt has better things to do, or if I have better things to do.
Okay, sounds good. All right,
take care.
Talk to you later. Thanks.